We are at the beginning of the 10th parak. We did the opening couple of psukim, just these, the opening sentences last time. The war on behalf of Givon. And we'll get into a discussion of miracles. We'll see how far we get in it. It's for sure not something we're going to conclude this week. You can see by the fact there are two sheets for the source sheets that there's an awful lot of material, and there's more that's after we finish all the stuff that's on the sheets. So, yeah, no, there's a lot going on here. But remember that we began Perek Tet, right? We began chapter 9 with the various nations getting together, the kings of the nations, I should say, getting together, planning for war against the Jews. They heard about what happened in Yericho, they heard about what happened in Ai, and the people of Givon, long story short, approach Yehoshua, and approach the nation, and then approach Yehoshua, and say, we're from far away, we would like to make a treaty with you. They trick the Jews into believing that they are, in fact, from far away. We talked about why, whether being near or far actually matters. That's already old news. But they make a treaty. Then Yehoshua and the nation find out that actually these are their next-door neighbors, or really they're in their midst, as we said. And at that point, they say, well, if we break this, it's a treaty that's been made with the knowledge of everybody else all around us. It's publicly known. And it would be a disaster if we would get the reputation of not keeping up our word. So therefore, we're not going to go to war against you. But on the other hand, we're going to make you the wood choppers and the water drawers for the Mishkan. And Mishkan, the nation, that's part of the discussion from last time. But that brought us to the beginning of Perek Yud, chapter 10, in which Adoni Tzedek, king of Yerushalayim, and last time we read the Radak, who said that the kings of Yerushalayim generally were known as Adoni Tzedek, Malki Tzedek, always something to do with Tzedek, with justice, with righteousness. And we're going to come back to that in a little bit. But Adoni Tzedek, king of Yerushalayim, hears about what's happened in Ai, hears about what's happened in Yericho, and hears that the citizens of Givon have made this treaty with the Jews, and they are in their midst. And last time we said it's not quite clear who is in whose midst. Yeah, there are a couple of different ways to read that. Vayira'u ma'od, and they were very afraid. Because Givon is a huge city, like one of the cities of the empire. This is a serious city. Bigger than Ai, and its men are all mighty, and yet they've made peace with the Jews. So what I wanted to start with today is the wordiness of these opening couple of Pesukim. Bless you. Right? When Adoni Tzedek, king of Yerushalayim, heard that Yehoshua conquered Ai and destroyed it, as he had done to Yericho and to her king, so he did to Ai and to her king. It just seems like there are extra words here. You could have done this more briefly. And he heard that the people of Givon had made peace with the Jews, and they were in their midst, and he was afraid because Givon was. There's too much here. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number one, Abarbanel unpacks these sentences to identify four different concerns that the king of Yerushalayim had. Lagid shemelach Yerushalayim chashav shekvar pashu yoshvei Givon bazeh arba pshiot gedolot. He felt that Givon had committed four pshiot. It should really be arba, I suppose. But I copied this straight out of Abarbanel, so I guess the typo's his. But there were four sins involved. Ha'achat, the first one. Shebihiyot shel achad Yehoshua Yericho v'ha'ai u'malcheihem ha'yaro'oi l'chol yoshvei ha'aret sheitzta'aru alav yishtadlu l'nkom nikmato. He says, first of all, he heard Yehoshua conquered Ai, and Yehoshua conquered Yericho, and he had conquered their kings. Everybody should be upset about this, and should want to avenge Ai and Yericho. So the first thing that upsets Adoni Tzedek is, we are all good citizens. We look out for each other. An invader has just come in. An invader has conquered a couple of the cities. You don't go out and make peace with them. You go out to war with them. That's what you're supposed to do. And you can imagine what it does to the bond between the nations who live there if they know that, well, if we get destroyed, then they're just going to make peace with the people who conquered us. They should all feel confident that they stand as one against an invader. So that's number one. Number two, Hashenit, Chashav Eich, and I dot-dot-dotted a few different places just because it was rather long. But the second point that the king was upset about was, he thought, Yoshvei Givon Mardu B'Malkam, that, as Abarbanel had already said, that the people of Givon did this without their king's involvement. The king was involved in the council of war. They said, we don't think that's a good idea, and they went out on their own to negotiate with a foreign power. They threw him literally behind themselves. He's pulling a piece out of a pasuk from Tanakh for that. And they went to make peace with Yahushua. This is a plot that they're making. It's a coup. The idea that without their king's knowledge they should make peace with the enemy. That's a great rebellion. And it's not just that he's offended by the impropriety of it, but, you know, things like that spread, right? Think Arab Spring, you know, circa however many years ago. That's the that's what we're talking about here. He says this could become a trend. Maybe the citizens of Yerushalayim are going to decide to do this next. And so that's his second piece. And that's why he emphasizes, if you take a look back at Pasuk Aleph again, he emphasizes the king piece, right? As they had done to Yericho and her king, so they did to Ai and her king. And Yoshvei Givon, the residents of Givon, had made peace. It's the contrast between kings and citizens. Third point that he makes is that he feels like Givon has enabled the Jews. The third point, Chashav Shanshei Milchama, the Kol Shkenim Nishayhem V'Tapam Miknehem V'Tzonam, Lo Yuchlu Eich Pasadeh Zman Rav. He's thinking to himself, you know, these Jews are new in the land. They don't have built-up cities. You have all these warriors, not to mention their wives, their children, their cattle. Where in the world are they going to stay? Im Lo Yela Hamarim L'Shavet, if they don't have cities in which to dwell. And Yahushua can't just say, well, we'll take over Yericho and Ai, because they destroyed them. And I wasn't sure when he said Hachrimam whether he only meant destroyed or also consecrated, when they had said, you're not allowed to live there, you're not allowed to build it up. So I added both in the translation. And therefore the war wasn't going to last unless the people of Givon make peace, and then they start billeting the soldiers and, you know, giving them all places to stay and food to eat. That would enable the Jews to fight longer. So not only have they not been loyal to their neighbors who were destroyed, and not only have they started a trend potentially of the citizens acting without their king, again, you know, with a foreign power, which is, you know, something that you think is kind of reserved for the leadership. But in addition to that, they're actually supporting the enemy by doing this, making it easier for the enemy. And then finally, Vaharviit, the fourth point, Chashav Shegivon, Asan Nevalah, Behishlimim Yisrael, Leyota Ir Gedola Meha'ai. He says, Givon has done something terrible, shameful even, by making peace with Israel, because they're bigger than I, that last point that he made. Vanasha Giborim, and their citizens are mighty. Vim kol ze lo atzru koch lihilachim v'alchul hashlim, and yet they didn't have the strength to fight, and they went instead to make peace. It's a terrible thing. We've lost great warriors by doing this. So he has four different reasons. And all of this, Abarbanel draws from the opening psukim. The way that it emphasizes the conquest of Yericho and Ai is his first point, how they should have wanted to avenge Yericho and Ai. His second point about them betraying their king, emphasized by the contrast between kings and Yoshvim, the residents. The third point was Vayu Bekirbam, they're in their midst. Right at the end of Pasuk Aleph, they're in their midst, and that's going to enable the Jews to be able to survive longer. And the point about them being mighty is emphasized in Pasuk Bet, when he talks about how they're such a great city and their people are warriors. So Abarbanel picks it apart to show these are actually four separate points that they're making. You follow?
No, but they didn't enter Yericho 2 minutes ago. Where have they been staying? Where have they been doing for food? What?
Mm-hmm. And the answer. So the answer is, well, in terms of the man, no, we finished with the man last year.
They
but they have already started buying from whatever they have in the land, if they encounter that, they've started taking from fields, I suppose, if there are fields outside of Yericho and Ai. But yeah, we had talked about that. They're done with that. And in terms of where they're staying, Gilgal is the base. That's where the Mishkan is. And presumably they're roughing it. But he's right that it's not easy to do that for long. That's not a plan. You know, you do that when you're stuck. So that's exactly his point, is that they've now made it easier for the Jews. He's not, you know, Adoni Tzedek is dead, but he's not wrong. He's not going to win this war, that we know. But he's absolutely right for being so upset about what Givon has done. So what does he do? Pasuk Gimel, I think we read through Pasuk Zion last time, we just didn't explain it. But Pasuk Gimel, we get a list of all the different kings he summons to his side, and he's summoning the kings, and potentially what he has voiced will resonate with them.
Is this the southern part? I'm sorry, like geographically, these are the southern kings?
So we are still in the area of Yerushalayim. So if you look at, the Dan Mikra tries to come up with identification of where each of these populations are. And he mentions a few places that may be associated with them, but the ones that stand out right off the bat are, you see Yerushalayim, you see Hebron. So that gives us some sense of this. And I could read out what he's saying here, but I'm not sure how much it would help us really in terms of this. So, but these are basically, well, some of them, I was going to say they're all in the mountain, but they're not. Some of them are in the low-lying areas also. So he sends this message to them, and he says, "Alu elai v'izruni, ascend to me, help me out, v'naket Givon, and we will strike Givon." Well, they gather together. These five are all kings of the Emori, as are enumerated again in Pasuk Hei. And they fight Givon, and in Pasuk Vav, sentence 6, the people of Givon send to Yehoshua, to Gilgal. And they say, "Al terav yadecha me'avadecha, do not weaken your hand from your servant, from helping your servant. Alei eleinu me'ira, ascend us quickly. Yoshia lanu ve'azreinu, help us out. Well, save us and help us out. Kinik bitsu eleinu kol machayo emori yoshvei ahar, because all of the kings of the Emori, dwellers of the mountain, have gathered to us." By what right do they call to the Jews to help them? What does the pact say? All the pact says that we know of is
we won't.
The pact says the Jews aren't going to kill Givon, and Givon is going to work for the Jews. That's what you have as your pact. So it's not at all clear on what basis this call is made.
I feel like they're dead otherwise, so they might as well try.
Maybe, but it sounds like they're calling in some kind of an obligation. Do not weaken your hand from your servant. Sounds like it's somehow a function of the relationship. It doesn't have to be. In truth, it doesn't have to be. But take a look at source number 2. Ralbag does seem to take it as sort of a moral thing, that it's not from the treaty. Shalchu anshei Givon Yehoshua sheyazrim. The people of Givon sent to Yehoshua for help. Ki ra'ui la'adon sheyatzil avadav miyad hanelchamim alayam. It's appropriate for the master to save his servants from those who would fight against them. The last part, actually, I'm going to hold off on for a minute. I'm not ready for the last part. So, the interesting thing about this, really, in terms of what Ralbag is saying, that it's since we are your servants, therefore you ought to be interested in helping us. So, what that means is, had the Jews agreed with the original deal, meaning had Givon not been wood choppers and water drawers, right? Had they gone with the original deal in which they're not their servants, the Jews would not have been called into this deal, into this war. Because you made us your servants, now you have some kind of moral obligation to take care of us.
I don't think they do.
But that's their argument. Their claim is you do.
I know, but they tricked them into that, so it's kind of...
Well, that's the whole question in general, right?
Based on how Adoni Tzedek is pegging them, like, now you left us, now you're best friends with these guys. They kind of feel like they're the only ones left out there to call to for help. No one else is going to help them.
Right, and it could be. It's just desperation. You know, this is just, help. somebody, you know, that it could entirely be that. I looked at some papers on treaties in the ancient Near East to try to see if there is any sense that, like, you'd have some kind of mutual defense obligation. And the problem is that the papers I read, by and large, quote this as their source to say that, yes, there is mutual defense, because, look, they had to. You don't apparently have much to go on in this material. There are a couple of non-biblical treaties that they quote, but I didn't see anything hard and fast determining that, yeah, you'd have this kind of an obligation. One thing that is interesting, sort of beyond this and taking it as a larger idea, is that we do the same thing. We turn to God, right? On Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur especially, we call God a parent, but we also call God our king, right? And we call ourselves his servants. Right? The Kenei Avadim Ayad Adonaihem, and so on. We have all sorts of ways in which we say we are the Eved and Hashem is the Adon, and therefore Hashem should take care of us. Right? I wonder if there isn't this sort of sense, and it's not in the text at all, but I still wonder, of, you know, if we say no to them, then maybe God says no to us. We are Avadim of Hashem. We, as masters, don't help our Eved. So Hashem may turn around and say, well, then I'm not going to help you. You didn't keep up your end of the end of an arrangement. I wonder about that.
Well, so what was the responsibility in those times, just societal norms around, or even Jewishly, if you have an Eved, what's your responsibility to them? Are they part of your household? Are you supposed to...
No, it's not as a treaty issue, but as a personal issue.
Yeah, food and all those things.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question. I don't know. I mean, I know that within the Jewish version of it, yes, you have all sorts of responsibilities. I don't know what Givon would have known about, mm-hmm. you know, and what would have been familiar to them. But that's an interesting idea. Maybe it doesn't have to do with the treaty. It has to do with being somebody's Eved. I work for this person, and this person has a responsibility to me. It's an interesting idea. I don't know. But however you slice it, they go to the Jews. Whether they're going to the Jews because it's a function of their agreement, whether because they're desperate, whether because it was a moral obligation of course you should do it, maybe it's because just you're the personal Eved, and therefore the master has to save you. Whichever one we take, the reality is they call to the Jews and they say, Mehera, right? You have Aleinu Mehera, come ascend to us quickly. V'hoshi'a lanu v'ozreinu. Hoshi'a is save. Ozreinu is help. Right? Why is it in this order? I would have thought.
Help and then we'll save.
Yeah,
in case they won't help him, at least they should save
him. I'm sorry?
In case they won't do.
Well, then the order is backwards. It's the other way around. And Malbim actually says the idea was save us, or if you won't save us, at least help us do something, right? Even if the United States isn't going to intercede on behalf of the state of Israel, at least let them send a weapon or you know, veto something in the UN. You know, do something. We would really like Hoshienu, but if it won't be Hoshienu, at least Ozreinu. Yeah.
Throw us a bone.
Yeah, something.
Can it be maybe save us? And once we are saved, then help us to be able to fight also. Help us to help you. Help us.
How would that work?
To then partake in the war. Save us because we're about to be hit.
Right.
And then once you've saved us, then we can now help us to then fight with you further. No?
Could be. In other words, in future wars?
No. Not after. To continue the war.
In other words...
To fight back.
Right. So first defend us. And then help us to be on the offensive. It's an interesting idea.
They're not attacking Yeshua, right?
Right. No, Yeshua. It appears is not the target
it's
here.
Interesting, because the parent before they seem to get together to one attack. You know,
right.
Yeshua, and all of a sudden now, why don't they just do it all together? I don't know. It seems they just want Givon. They just want to get back at Givon now.
Right. Well, I think they feel like they're not ready. I mean, the group before, keep in mind, if you flip back to that group, there it was...
This is just the Amori, and that was all the other...
Yeah, there it was Chiti, Amori, Knani, Prizi, Chivi, Yavusi. This is just five Amorite kings.
They will take it on now.
Yeah.
So it might be strategically better, actually, to fight them now when there's more room to do that.
wait until they...
For us to fight them.
For
yes.
Strategically for Yoshua.
Yes, and that's going to be an important point. So hold that thought for sure. So what does Yoshua do? In Pasuk Zayin, Vayal Yoshua min ha-Gilgal, Yoshua goes up from Gilgal, Hu v'chol ama milchama imo, with all of the warriors, right? We've learned from our mistakes. We don't say, well, we just need a few thousand here. We send everybody. And Yoshua goes along with them, right? Which is another lesson that we learned in Ai. V'chol giborei ha-chayel, all of the warriors. So the question, which I think I mentioned last time, you know, did he or did he not consult with Hashem? So Ralbag, I started reading it in source number 2, the end of that line, V'yidmeh, right? Presumably, I would assume, Sheshal Yoshua et pi Hashem al zeh, Yoshua asked Hashem what he should do. But the pasuk doesn't say so. Right? It doesn't say whether Yoshua consulted or not. So Ralbag says, yeah, I didn't need to say so. Of course Yoshua consulted. Given the track record of even the previous Perek in which he made the peace treaty without asking Hashem, I'm not sure on what basis Ralbag says, presumably he asked.
Well, maybe he learned his lesson from the last time.
But there was no lesson taught. Hashem didn't come to him after making the treaty and say, You're in trouble. I mean, the lesson could be it didn't work out. I mean, he found out that he had made the treaty under false pretenses. You know, that he had been fooled. So from that, he learned that he should consult. Maybe.
Maybe the Hashem is talking to him already, so maybe he's responding to him.
Right. So we have to get to what happens in Pasuk Chet and see Hashem's role in this. But I'm not clear on what makes Ralbag make this assumption. None of the other commentators even address it, to ask this question of what Yoshua was doing here. But I do find it particularly interesting that the nation is with him. Right? The nation is with Yoshua in this decision. Despite what happened in the previous parak, where they were upset about making the covenant, right? They're still going to be behind him. They were not happy. At that point, they weren't happy with the Nisim, they weren't happy with whoever they weren't happy with, they were not happy about it. And now they're just going to go with him. So it could be he consulted Hashem and they knew it, and the Pasuk just leaves it out. That's one explanation. Or it could be they just have this level of confidence in him at this point, the far cry from where he was at the start of the Sefer. Right? In the beginning of the book, it was, well, if God is with you, then we'll be with you. Right? Now Yeshua says, we're going to war to save the people who tricked us. And the people say, yeah, let's go to war to save the people who tricked us. It's a remarkable idea.
Didn't Yoshua, like when we were talking about the logistics, stand in the middle of all the people, and I don't know which character it was earlier.
Yeah.
When they were going into the city from the north.
Yeah.
From the west, like he stood in the middle, so maybe he gained all their confidence from that. Like,
yeah.
He went amongst the people.
Well, that was the thing. It's been very up and down. Like, you're right. After the first war with Ai, he's in trouble. After the second war with Ai, he's a hero. After making a pact with Givon, he's in trouble. And now, apparently, he's a hero.
How many generations in between each of these things? Maybe it's a new group of people.
Days.
Oh, this is your son, yeah.
Days, yeah. This is all playing out very quickly. That's the indication that we have. So, it is interesting that they're all just rallying with him, and they're going to go to war with him. Now, I wanted to just include one side note here, because I didn't know where else to put it. But we mentioned, the last time we mentioned, and I mentioned at the beginning this time also, that Radak notes that the kings of Yerushalayim are given names that are associated with tzedek, with righteousness. So this is a theme throughout Tanakh. The Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah picks up on it. I brought it for you in source number 3. Yerushalayim is identified as the place that is matzdik et yoshvav, that makes its residence just. And they pick up on Yerushalayim itself being called tzedek, tzedek yalin ba. The idea is that the city itself somehow has this association with righteousness, and that plays out, as I said, throughout Tanakh, in terms of the name of the city. And I gave you references in source number 4. The first two references there, in Yeshaya Perek Aleph and in Yirmiyah Perek Lamed Gimel, Yerushalayim is actually called Tzedek. Yikarei lach l'cha ir ha-tzedek. you will be called the city of Tzedek. The pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Yerushalayim will be called Hashem Tzidkenu. God is our righteous leader. In terms of the identity of the city, it is the city in which Tzedek resides. That's Yeshaya 121 and Yirmiyahu Hey Aleph. The one from Yirmiyahu, the statement is, if there is anybody of Tzedek in the city, then Hashem will forgive the city for its sins. Which is why the Beis HaMikdash, or maybe a reason why, the Beis HaMikdash is the seat of the Sanhedrin. Right? The Sanhedrin sits in Lishkas Hagaz, it's a room inside the Beis HaMikdash. So that we're told, and that's the reference I gave you at the end of number 4, the Pasuk in Devarim Yudzayin, that when you have a dispute, so you go to the Kohanim and the Shofet, who will be there in that time. The Kohanim and the Shofet are together, because the Kohanim are in the Beis HaMikdash, and that's where the Sanhedrin is. And that's where justice takes place. And I gave you references in source 5 and source 6 about how Hashem is found in the place where justice is, the judge is the partner with Hashem. So the overall point that I'm trying to make here is, when he's called Adoni Tzedek, he is the master of the city that is called Tzedek. Malki Tzedek is king of the city that is the city of Tzedek. And I gave you in source number 7 a shir that I found online. Written up at this on this website, where they talk more about Yerushalayim and its associations with Tzedek. There's much more that you can say, but that's the little tangent there. Bottom line: the Jews are behind Yehoshua and ready to go out to war with Givon. Well, war on behalf of Givon, I should say. When you say war with, that's always open to interpretation. So let's take a look at what happens. Psukim Chet to Yudalit, sentences 8-14. Vayomer Hashem el Yehoshua, al tira mehem ki v'yadcha nesatim. Lo and behold, as Alina said, Hashem speaks to Yehoshua. And he says to Yehoshua, don't be afraid, don't fear them. Ki v'yadcha nesatim, because I have given them into your hand. Lo ya'amod ish mehem befanecha, none of them will stand before you. Vayavo aleihem Yehoshua pitaom, and Yehoshua attacks suddenly. Kol halayla alam in haGilgal, all night long, he ascended from Gilgal. Now, how does that work? If it's sudden,
all night long.
So, what does that mean?
Unexpected.
Took him all night to be sudden.
Well, yes, actually. Did they attack people at night?
No.
No, you don't attack at night. Remember, we had this whole thing in the... Exactly. So, they are arriving at the scene, wherever the scene of the battle is, Givon's city, wherever this is. They are... Well, we learned about the cities of Givon last time, actually. We know where their cities are. So, the entire military camp is filing out of Gilgal. All night, they're traveling, thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And finally, they're there, and so they're able to attack suddenly at dawn. That's the way that I would understand that. Vayuhumeim Hashem lifnei Yisrael. Hashem confused them, the enemy, before the Jews. Vayakeim makah gedola begivon. He sounds like it's referring back to Hashem. Right? He struck them a mighty blow in Givon. Vayirdefeim derech ma'alei beit choron. And he chased them via the path of Beit Choron. Beit Choron is mentioned various times in the Gemara as a very narrow space. So it's a place where it's ascending upwards, and it's a narrow path, like between the rocks. Or, if I remember correctly, actually, there are rocks on one side and a cliff on the other. So you don't want to go off the side. But it's a this is where he chases them. I don't remember now where that is. Alright, anyway. The Vayakem at Azeka ve'ad Makeda. He beat them from to Azeka and to Makeda. Sounds good so far. Vayihi benusam ibnei Yisrael. And it was when they were fleeing before Israel. Hemet bimorad Beit Choron. They are now on the descent from Beit Choron. Vashem hishlich aleihem avanim gedolot min hashamayim ad Azeka vayamutu. And Hashem threw large stones down from the heavens upon them to Azekah, and they died. There may be a pun. I wonder about a pun in there. The word lazok is used for taking stones out of a field. Like when you want to be able to plant in a field, there are stones there. So you take the stones out. That's that term. Or maybe that term comes from here. I don't know. Okay. Rabim asher mezu ba'avnei ha'barad me'asher hargu b'nei Yisrael be'charev. More people died from the stones of Barad than who died from the actual battle. You notice the change in the name of the stones? Are these stones?
Avnei
Barad. What is Barad? Right? This week's Parsha? Well, last week's Parsha. So we're going to have to talk about these hail stones.
They felt like stones.
Right. We'll have to see. But that's the fall of the stones upon them. And then, now that they have, number one, been routed in battle, number two, had hail/stones rain down on them, killing more of them than died in the battle. Az yidaber Yehoshua l'Hashem. Then Yehoshua spoke to God. That az yidaber is a formulation we've seen before. The az, which sounds like then in the future, but it doesn't have to be. B'yom teis Hashem es ha'amori lepnei bnei Yisrael, on the day when Hashem gave the Amori before the Jews. V'yomer le'inei Yisrael, and he said before the eyes of Israel, Shemesh b'giv'on dom, sun in giv'on be silent. V'yareach be'emek ayalon, and the moon in the valley of Ayalon. Vayidom Hashemesh, and the sun was silent. Vayareach Amad, and the moon halted. Ad Yikom Goy Oyvav, until the nation was able to avenge itself upon its enemies. Halohik Suval Sefer Hayashar, it is written in the book. Sefer Hayashar, the book of the righteous. Vayamod Hashemesh Bachatzi Hashamayim, Velo Atz Lavo Kiyom Tamim. The sun stood in the middle of the sky. It did not hasten to set for a full day. Velo Hayak Hayom Ahu Lefanav Ve'acharav. And there was never another day like it, not before it, and not after it. Lishmo Hashem Bekol Ish, for God to listen to the voice of a human being. Ki Hashem Nilcham Li Yisrael, because Hashem fought for Israel. There's a lot going on here. Questions?
Which part is Hashem doing? Which part are the people doing?
Well, what does it sound like?
Well, Hashem moving is obviously Hashem.
It sounds almost entirely Hashem.
But Hashem is doing it.
Hashem struck them. Hashem threw down the stones. Hashem made the sun stop. Right.
Well, also the sun never moves. Right. The sun always still.
Is that true?
Don't we revolve around the sun?
Well, everything moves. Everything in the universe moves.
Okay.
But you're right in the sense that we technically speaking, we are the ones who are in motion around the sun. But the way people describe things, presumably the creator of the sun knew.
Yes.
But the way that things are always going to be described from the standpoint of the human being, you know, the most ardent believer in Copernicus and Galileo still talks about sunrise and sunset, even though the sun neither rises nor sets.
True.
That's just the way it goes. This is the way we look at it.
That's how we experience it.
In Yunchet also, it feels like, just the way it's described, it's an ongoing conversation. It doesn't feel like Hashem suddenly came out and spoke to him. Just, I don't know, maybe Hashem did, but it sounds like part of a conversation, even though it didn't say before that Yonshua checked it out.
It's certainly very, it's kind of abrupt. If only because, Vayomer, and he said, has this kind of an implication. And Hashem said to Yoshua, in addition to something else before. You're right, it does, there is a paragraph break in Tanakh there, so that does give us the option that this is something new, but it does seem like there should be something before it. What else? There's an awful lot here that's weird.
It seems that, like, why did Yeshua even have to ask that? Like, God was killing everybody. What was his reasoning for this whole,
Who needs this miracle?
Yeah, like, why this? Like, why couldn't Hashem just kill them all and it's finished?
Well, there are two questions then. Question number one is, who needs anything? At this point, they've struck them in the battle. The stones or hail or whatever this is beating down on the enemy. Gibeon is likely safe at this point. What's this request for? The hold up the sun and the moon, please. We want to make sure that we fully prosecute this war. And then along with it, why this? Right? Why not say, God, we'd really appreciate it if you would just take care of this for us.
And also, even with the barad, God could have just finished the whole job with the barad.
Yeah,
it's one thing, but there's some room left for them to kill people with the harem. It wasn't.
And what is this barad?
Yeah.
What is this about? This wasn't an airstrike that Yehoshua called in, right? Hashem has helped them before in battle without barad. We don't know, like, Hashem helps Moshe, in the wars on the eastern side of the Yarden. We don't know anything about any barad there. What is all this? And by the way, who cares about the moon? Right? The point is that the sun should stop. Right? You want to buy more time for the war.
Not only to the sun, but the moon also.
Yeah, but why does Yeshua request it?
Yeah.
God, stop the sun, please. Let the moon go where it wants. And not to mention, what is the Sefer Hayashar?
And also, he says a kind of like, hello, like, don't you know, like, isn't it a negative? It's like, is it not written there? Like, almost kind of like, do you not, if you don't believe me that this happened.
Well, that's exactly what it is, I think.
Yeah,
he's speaking to the reader and saying, you may not like this, but it's there. It's in the Sefer Hayashar.
But I promise you, this, kind of like.
Right. I mean, we're going to see more about that as we look at what Sefer Hayashar is. But yeah, it is. It's an attempt to convince.
Yeah.
Yes. So this whole thing requires some closer attention. Fortunately, the commentators were alert to all this. So, first of all, in terms of Hashem intervening, I've seen three ideas. On a very simple level, it's for the sake of the Jews to make sure that they're going to win and they'll be safe and fine. That's the straightforward read. On a deeper level, I think that it's supporting Yehoshua. In other words, to show that Yehoshua has not lost his support, Hashem calls to Yehoshua. Yehoshua is rallying the troops and saying, we're going to go fight against Gibeon. Not against Gibeon, on behalf of Gibeon. And Hashem says to Yehoshua, I'm with you. I am going to support you in this, despite the treaty that you made that was inappropriate. Nonetheless, I'm going to be on your side. So I think that's another level to what's going on. But there's one more piece of it. Go back to the oath that they made in the previous parak. This was noted in an article in Biblical Archaeologist, volume 27. The writer is F. Charles Fensham, or Fensham. I assume it's Fensham. Look at the way the oath was made to them. It's Pasuk. It was Perek Tet Pasuk with Vav. Now, what I wanted was, hang on. No, that's not it. That is not it. Yeah, there it is. Pasuk Yotet. It's in the report of the Brit. Right? When the Nesi'im are explaining why they're stuck with their oath. So in Pasuk Yotet, the Nesi'im say to the nation, Anachnu nishbanu lahem b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. We swore by God. So because Hashem's name was invoked in the Brit, Hashem has to get involved in the defense. He is a party in this agreement. I thought that was an interesting idea.
But if that was the Brit had nothing to do with defending them.
Well, if you're going to say the Brit did, then this argument makes sense. If the Brit has nothing to do with it, then you're right. Then Hashem is just there to be supportive of Yehoshua and to protect the nation to make sure nobody gets hurt.
That's like what appears to people to be the we call supernatural, like out of the ordinary natural phenomena happening, raises Yehoshua's status, raises an Israel status among all the other nations, because here's a time where everybody's kind of jockeying and figuring out who's stronger, who's dominant, so the other nations see that these things that are outside the law of their nature are happening, it becomes intimidating.
And that's going to be a major theme here, is the idea of cementing the reputation of the nation. So yes, I think that is a part of it. Acting for the Jews isn't only about their safety, it's also, yes, about their honor and their reputation and letting everybody know that that God is with them. So they go out to war, and Yoshua is with them, and the whole nation is with them, and they do this surprise attack at dawn. They're not just relying on God, but they're doing, you know, a sound tactic. And then you get hailstones. So take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 8. Where the Gemara does something very sharp. It's picking up on, actually before that, those who have a Tanakh, which some of you do. Okay, if you take a look first at Shemot Perek Tet Pasuk Lamed Gimel, 9:33.
Perek Tet?
Mm-hmm. Sorry?
156.
Lamed Gimel. Lamed Gimel. Okay. Mm-hmm. Chapter 9, sentence 33. Okay. So there, this is the end of the plague of Barad, right? And what happens? What's the description? Where are the stones? What have? How did this stop? Yeah. That's when it starts. I gave you the wrong pasuk.
No,
it's
fair.
No,
it doesn't fall. Does it stop?
Are you in the right pair?
I think you made not.
You want Ted Lamed
Gimel? Yeah.
No, you are wrong.
I am right. Lamed Gimel.
Okay.
Lamed Dal keeps on going, and then Lamed Hei. But yeah, Lamed Dal keeps on going.
Why do I?
Rav Rish Gushen. Yeah,
he puts his hands up.
What I want is where it says Ubarad Lo Nitach Arza. That's the end of the pasuk I'm looking for.
Yeah.
It is Lamed Gimel. Okay.
And the rain did not reach the earth.
So he puts his hands up and stops mid-air?
Yeah. When Moshe stops the plague of Barad,
just stops right.
There's stuff in the heavens. There's stuff there, and it just freezes, so to speak. But that's right there. It's in the psukim. It just stops. So the question is, what happened? What in the world happened to the stuff that was in midair?
It's waiting to come down now.
So that is source number 8.
It's sitting there waiting for this next turn.
Well, the thing is, it's not quite sitting there because it's moved. Right. But take a look at source number 8. Source number 8 is from the 9th chapter in Brachot. The 9th chapter in Brachot, the opening Mishnah, talks about brachot made on special occasions, including brachot, a bracha that's made to praise Hashem. When you see Avnei Al Gabish, the stones of El Gabish, which are described in the Mishnah as being b'ma'alat Beit Choron, in the path going up in Beit Choron. So, the Mishnah there says, you make a bracha when you see the stones of El Gabish on Ma'alat Beit Choron. And the truth of the matter is that we have a reference to the stones of El Gabish in the 13th chapter of Yechezkel. But in the 13th chapter of Yechezkel, the vision is that the false prophets will be punished with Avnei El Gabish, stones of El Gabish, but it doesn't mention anything about Ma'alat Beit Choron, this place of Beit Choron, or of any particular moment when it happened. We don't have a historical statement. Here, the Mishnah essentially is borrowing a term from Yechezkel, this term for stones that are supposed to fall upon false prophets, and saying, when you see these stones in Ma'alat Beit Choron, you make a bracha. But again, Yechezkel didn't mention Ma'alat Beit Choron. And number two, Yechezkel isn't describing a historical event. He's saying, this will be the punishment of. So how do we understand this this Mishnah? So that's what the Gemara wants to know. Avnei El Gabish. My Avnei El Gabish. Tana. Avanim sha'amdu al gav ish v'yardu al gav ish. Play on words. Right? The Al Gav Ish, because of a man, due to a man. So these are stones that stood because of an Ish, and they descended due to an Ish. What do you mean? Amdu Al-Gav Ish Ze Moshe. They stood because of a man, that's Moshe, who stopped them. How do I know Moshe is called an Ish? V'ha'ish Moshe Anav Me'od, right? That's the description of Moshe. Uchsiv, V'achdalu HaKalot V'abarad Matarna Litach Arza, and it says, in fact, they stopped and they did not strike the land. Yardu Al-Gav Ish, and they descended via an Ish, Ze Yehoshua. When is Yehoshua called an Ish? Kach l'chad Yehoshua bin Nun, Ish asher ruach ba, when Hashem tells Moshe to take Yehoshua, who is an Ish, with spirit in him, and then the Pasuk here has these stones descend. So these are the hailstones that didn't descend at the end of Parshas Vayera. That's what's going on here. Well, it resolves a Pasuk, and it resolves a problematic term in a Mishnah. So it's a very neat, you know, kind of wrap everything up in a bow type of a thing. What's particularly interesting about it, though, is it connects the Jews entering Israel with the Jews who experienced these miracles in Egypt. Right? That's the age of miracles. That generation experiences divine intervention like no other. The one that gets out of Mitzrayim. Whether you're talking about the Makos in Egypt, or you're talking about getting through the sea, or getting the man and the water from a stone and all that. So what Hashem is now doing by giving them the remnants of the Barad is to say, I will be for you as I was for them. That's a very reassuring message, although kind of. It's kind of a mixed message, because now that they're in the land, they're told they also have to take over and run things themselves. So, on the one hand, it's sort of like, this is not a good comparison, but I'm going to make the comparison anyway. It's sort of like the parent who, on the one hand, wants the child to be independent, but on the other hand, keeps on helping anyway. You know, not that any of us, you know, ever do that. But that's, you know, that's what it sort of feels like. You know, like, on the one hand, Hashem is saying, you know, figure this stuff out, and you have to run the country now, and there will be fewer miracles at this stage. And on the other hand, but I'm always willing to write a check, you know? I'm always willing to send you Barad or whatever it is, just like I did back in Mitzrayim. So, yes, the stones are hailstones, and they're not just any hailstones, but they are old hailstones. The ones from 40 years earlier. Yeah.
No, I never heard of that before, but couldn't it also just be that the pasuk there, "Matar lo nitach arza," could just mean no more rain or hail continued to fall? They stopped midway.
Right, so if you didn't have another explanation for it, then that's probably what you would say. In other words,
it's literally hanging in the sky for 40 plus years.
Well, I don't think it's hanging where people can see it, because that would be weird. Mm-hmm. Although it would intimidate Egypt. Yeah.
I think so.
But no, if I didn't have another, so to speak, another appearance of Barad, you know, I would, that would be my assumption.
Did you hear about the features of the fire and the ice?
Yeah,
the fire,
didn't think about fire.
Compare it to those, maybe it was a completely different one.
Well, the thing is that Barad doesn't have to have fire. It's Eish Mitlakachat Mitoch HaBarad. There was fire mixed in with the Barad there. Mm-hmm. But Barad itself isn't fire.
No, I always have that
vision.
Because we use the word Barad to refer to the whole Makkah. But Barad is really separate. Barad is the hailstone. And then there was fire along with it. And in that Pasuk there, where it talks about everything stopping, it doesn't mention anything about what happened to the fire. Mm-hmm. That Pasuk didn't say anything about what happened to the fire, the one in Va'era. It just said the stones were still up in the sky. And the matar didn't come down. That's it. Sorry, you were going to say, Aaliyah?
These are the only two cases of Barad in the whole Tanakh?
If I say yes, there's going to be another one.
Oh, I know. I know.
That's the way it works. So you have this reference to the Avnei El Gabish as a threat in Yechezkel, in the 13th parak there. And it's mentioned a couple of times. But I don't think there's actually an event with it.
Barad
yeah. I could be wrong. That's the hailstone attack, and then They're fleeing from the Jews. They've got these stones falling down. More of them are killed by the stones. And Yehoshua says, I think this would be a really good time for the sun to stop. Why in the world does Yehoshua make this request? So there are two approaches to the request that Yehoshua makes. One approach is sort of the simple and straightforward approach, which we kind of assume this is about based on the reading of the psukim themselves. But Abarbanel articulates it, and he says, Yehoshua looks and says, it's midway through the day. The sun is b'chatzi ha-shamayim, midway through the sky. Although I should note there are other commentators who take the phrase b'chatzi ha-shamayim differently, talking about cosmology and which is moving and all that. They say chatzi ha-shamayim, Abarbanel quotes it, is that the sun is above the earth. Meaning, the whole Shamayim is the part that's above us, but also the part that's on the other side of the earth. So Chatzi HaShamayim just means the sun is in the sky. Nonetheless, here, Abarbanel says, the sun is midway through the day. It's noon. And he says, you know, we don't have enough time to defeat them. They're going to get away. So, therefore, he says to Hashem, you know, if you just stop the sun so we'd have more daylight, we'd be able to finish the battle now. That's the simple and straightforward way to read it. Radak throws in a medrash. If you take a look at source number 9, that's particularly interesting. He says, he's picking up on something that we haven't gotten to yet, but the fact that the psukim, when they describe the sun stopping, seem to indicate that it stops twice, or that it stops in two different ways. And he is following the view that it stops for a total of 36 hours. Even though it said kiyom tamim for a complete day, that's one of the stops. The other stop is a 12-hour stop. We'll get to that, God willing, next week. But look what he says. Hamilchama ita be'erev Shabbat. He says the war was on Friday, because, you know, don't you know, that's always the way things happen. If it's going to happen any day of the week, it's going to be Friday. Right?
That's the source word. It's
true.
Yes.
It starts there.
And Yehoshua was afraid that the Jews would violate Shabbos. Now, mind you, they did that in Yericho, right? They fought in Yericho.
Allowed to, if it's
yes,
yeah.
Yes, and that's one reason why this medrash is particularly interesting. Maybe because this is a war for Givon, and they weren't themselves in danger, or maybe it's because, well, still lechatchila, I'd rather that we not have to do this on Shabbos. So Pashat Yadav Lamala, he extended his hands heavenward. Shayamod Hashemesh b'yom Hashishi, Kishir Yom Shabbos. His plea was for the sun to stop on Friday for the length of Shabbos, Kiyom Tamim, a full day. V'hayareach, and here comes the moon, Kishir Leil Shabbat, the length of time for Friday night, Umotza a Shabbat, as well as Saturday night. So that the sun will stop from when Friday night begins, all the way through to what should be daybreak Sunday morning. Ve'im shloshim v'sheish shaot, that's a 36-hour period.
What's the moon part? I don't understand how she put the moon part to the sun part.
The idea is that the moon won't come up, and so the sun is staying still in the sky. The moon is not ascending.
Why is it daylight going on?
So we have to see, but basically what his claim would be, taking this approach of the Medrash that Radak is saying, it would mean that the moon is currently ascending in the Valley of Ayalon right now as Yehoshua is making this plea, and he says, I want it to halt there. I don't want it to climb in the sky. I want the sun to stay up. I want the moon to just freeze where it is, low in the sky, and be that way through a night, a day, and a night.
Definitely a lot.
Are they tired?
Yeah, he doesn't mention that. I mean, I guess not, because, you know, they had the hailstones, and the hailstones were more effective than they were. You just don't tell them that it's nighttime. Abarbanel also asks the question, which I think Olina was asking before, which is, once you're asking for this, why not just ask Hashem to beat the enemy and be done with it? So Abarbanel offers two answers. One, going back to what Sima said before, it's about reputation. He wants something that is going to bring great honor to the Jews and let everybody know that Hashem is, in fact, with them performing miracles. And number two, because as far as Yehoshua is concerned, all miracles are the same for God. What's the difference between whether I ask God to halt the sun and the moon, or whether I ask God to, you know, crush the enemies with hailstones? You know, at the end of the day, he's God. It's easy enough for him.
Well, maybe the hailstones only they saw the hailstones, but the sun, everybody further out saw the sun. If you can't see a rainstorm over there, if you're over here.
Right. And the reputation thing is big, that idea. Now, we know, without a shadow of a doubt, that this is physically impossible. Okay? In the event that the sun were to halt relative to the Earth, meaning the Earth stopped spinning, we would have a whole host of problems. Yeah. Right? I mean, anything and everything you want to mention would be an issue. Whether you're talking about people flying off the planet because of centrifugal motion, or whether you're talking about the physics, the impact of it on, I don't know, things like the ocean, the atmosphere, you know, connections between all the other celestial things that are out there. Like, what exactly is freezing?
It's a big miracle already. So whatever, I mean, God can do anything. So
right.
He obviously suspended the rules of physics for that. You know,
right. The bottom line is, it's all wrapped up in the miracle. In other words, when you buy into the idea that this happened, you're buying into the idea that, yes, God is the creator of everything, and therefore he can just
stop it.
You know, make it and unmake it, so to speak, however he chooses. Because from the perspective of, you know, nature and the laws of science, Newton is going to run screaming from the room. This doesn't happen.
Wasn't there a whole article written about, you know, how it could be explanations to parting of the sea? You know, I don't know what
yeah, no, there have been a number of them.
The wind blew all night long.
The one miracle that really cannot be, like, you know, explained in scientific terms. Really.
Well, Ralbag is going to give it his best shot. And his answer is actually a very easy answer to how this happened. But I don't want to
like
give it away.
Or, you know, one of those weird, you know,
well, it would be an anti-eclipse.
Okay, right. Okay, you're right. Eclipse would be covering the sun.
Yeah. Years ago, when I taught Yoshua, it's got to be about, I don't know, 13, 14 years ago, I seem to remember seeing somebody who argued that it was an alignment of the clouds such that the sunlight would reflect longer. Even after the sun had gone down, there would still be illumination or something, you know. But that's not a real answer. That's not what he's describing here. And certainly not Kiyom Tamim for, you know, a complete day. This is a really hard chapter to take as anything other than throw up your hands and say, yes, God is clearly in charge of everything and doing whatever he likes. And if he wants to throw the laws of physics out the window, then yes, he's throwing the laws of physics out the window. And you just have to, you know, keep up. That's the simple and straightforward way to read this. Anything else, I think, is just missing it. But you'll see when we get to Ralbag what he does with this and how he handles it. We have to go through just the psukim themselves in terms of what happens here with the halting of the sun, what's the timing, what's the story with the moon, Sefer Hayashar, like there's all this stuff that we have to see. And then after that, I want to go through Ralbag versus Abarbanel. On what it was that actually happened with this. So we'll pick up with that, God willing, next week.